All right, now welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 696. Jason Lindgren is with me, and the Marquis, Fortune de Saint Germain, joins us. We're going to be covering, actually, we're going to compare and contrast the fall of French royalty at the end of the 1700s with the fall of Russian royalty, which happens in the very early 1900s. This is meant to be a follow-up from a non-mainstream account. In other words, there's actually valuable information here on what happened when the royalty of Russia fell and communism took over and how that happened. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a very hot good morning.
Mr. Fortune, welcome back.
Ah, how are you both? Greetings to you. How are you?
How are you? We are good. I understand you have an announcement. And from what I understand, your last event went, should I say, swimmingly.
Well, this announcement is not from the Golden Castle at the end of the world where the rainbow begins. This one is from the Alchemical Laboratory in London. And for anyone who's interested, we are doing a two-hour seminar strictly on alchemical principles. And that will be this Saturday, December the 12th, from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m., perhaps 3 p.m. if we run over. And that will be in central London in the Alchemical Laboratory. And all of the information will be on a separate reminder here on the Crow Show. And everyone is welcome. And everyone who attends gets worked on energetically by the teacher himself. That is yours truly. And the first one, for anyone who was interested, was a great success. We had 18 people who had come from all over the world. And so we're heading towards the second one, which is strictly on alchemical principles, and which is very, very sorely needed at this time, because we all know what condition the world is in. So if you want to insult somebody, you just tell them, I think the world of you, and you know what condition that's in.
All right. From what I understand, this is in and around tentatively at Mayfield or Mayfair. I'm sorry. Never been there. But we're going to jump in here. Fortune, actually, I'll ask you first, Jason. Is there anything you want to bring up before we start getting into this, Jason?
Well, obviously, we took an interest in this because of our communism episode, and we went into quite a lot of detail, actually, about what happened in Russia and how that went down. But I'm very confident and very interested in what Fortune has to fill out all of the information that is not so easily accessible.
What you're going to find from Fortune, we have talked about this period of time numerous times, and what you're going to get are accounts that I am reasonably sure are only in his head. And that's a fact, isn't it, Fortune?
Well, I knew many of these people who had escaped the revolution in Paris and New York City, and I knew their children and grandchildren. So, and my grandfather was very, very instrumental and very good to the Russian emigre community in Paris for those people who had escaped, the trying to set them up with positions, work, charity, because something we forget was when the Russian Revolution happened, 10% of the country left. And the flood of immigrants going into Western Europe was unlike anything ever seen before in the history of Europe.
Okay, so we're going to jump in. From what I understand, you're going to compare and contrast what happened in the late 1700s in France to the aristocracy, or basically royalty there, to what occurs when communism takes the reins in Russia in the early 1900s.
Correct. We're going to do the many, many parallels. So my young students, just like we had in the halls of Morris High School, get your pens and paper out and prepare to make notes. Also, fasten your seatbelts.
I'm ready. All right. What you're going to hear here is probably not going to be found on Wikipedia. Much of it may even correct some of what you find on Wikipedia, but it's from direct knowledge through a family line and more. Go ahead, Fortune.
Well, we start in France in 1789, and that breaks out basically the real revolution breaks out because of bread riots, food riots, and the same thing happened in the Russian Revolution during when Russia was at war in World War One. So the manifesto or the warning is that any country or any government is 2 days away from being toppled because of a food riot. When the food runs out, that's when people get angry and nasty. Revolutions and anger usually doesn't take to the streets until the food starts running out. So we have in 1789 in France, in 1917, bread riots, food riots, and both governments are toppled over that. And just to let you know, the parallels on both, the French Revolution was a communist revolution, even though it wasn't entitled so. And communism is the ultimate in the left-wing ideologies. No ownership of anything. The state owns everything. And it is a sorry excuse to plunder and murder.
We see a lot of left-leaning in this country now, so this should be particularly interesting.
History not only repeats itself, as Tolstoy said, it rhymes. So Plato said, who cannot remember the past is forever condemned to be a child. Santayana said, who cannot remember the past is forever condemned to repeat it. Tolstoy said, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. Hegel said, man shows us that history proves to us that man learns nothing from history. And Dr. John Gill, in the episode of the Nazis in Star Trek, who was a historian, said, even historians fail to learn from history.
And do you have any comment on where the communist ideas came from that might differ or be added to from what the mainstream says?
Oh, this is going to give fodder to so many people. I would say one of the principal places was from the Masons. There was a ban on Masonry almost everywhere. At the time the French Revolution broke out, there was a ban on Masonry in Russia under Catherine the Great. So the Masons were banned there. But let us go on and march into what brought about the revolution and what came afterwards and start to talk about the details, because they are very, very relevant in today's world, because the whole thing may be about to happen again in some way.
So are you picking up with the revolution in France, or are you picking up in Russia?
We're going to Russia with the Crimean War, where we're going to start with the Crimean War.
Okay, and how closely, I think most people watching this, we don't get a lot of Russian history in this country. Probably most people, the really only idea they have is probably the movie Dr. Zhivago. And I think I've heard you say that that is beyond glossed over.
Well, that's too late in the game, my friends. And just to let you know how crazy the communists were, Boris Pasternak survived the revolution. He was a writer in communist Russia. But his novel, Dr. Zhivago, could not be published in Russia because he had a love for a woman that was greater than his love for the state. So even though the doctor was kidnapped into the Red Army and forced to be a doctor in the army, the Bolshevik army, against his will, he deserted the army and went looking for his mistress, his lover. And that was a no-no in communism, because he was leaving the state for a woman, and the communists considered personal life in Russia dead. So we're talking about a fanatical world that communism, these people were mass murderers, 66 million people murdered by the Red Communists. It's called the Red Holocaust. Stalin was a bigger murderer than Hitler. And Mao was an even bigger murderer because he had more victims. So, well, as they say in Russia, in China, more volunteers to work with. So we will never know the actual numbers. The world communism, the deaths of the 20th century because of communism is well over 100 million people. And Dr. Zhivago could not be published because it was a romantic novel. And the Soviets were not interested in romanticism. They were interested in poems about fat women pulling the plow because the tractor broke down and the ox was sick. So they wrote poems to very fat women on the collective farms that pulled the plow and saved the harvest. or building dams, electro stations and dams and highways for the produce to reach the cities, and how the general production at a metal factory in Siberia tripled in 1 month because of some new commissar who had been assigned. And also in the newspapers in the 20s, in Pravda and Izvestia. Pravda means truth and Izvestia means the news. So the old adage was there is no news in the truth and no truth in the news. And they would write that the cow dung on the Soviet farms, the collective farms, smells sweeter than French perfume.
So Fortune, as you jump in now, in your estimation, how looming is the threat of communism in the age of technology in America right now?
Well, we talked about the Fabians, who are socialists, and they are in control, the World Economic Forum. These people are radical socialists and world communists. So it did not die. China is still there. It's a communist society. It's the world's largest concentration camp, and now it's an electronic prison. The Nazis and the Soviets only wish they had had this type of surveillance because they'd probably still be around. However, it's a threat to be taken seriously because the United States government, with the welfare state, which is now at over 50% of the population, is on benefits of some sort. So you already have socialism in the United States. And the Democratic Party is now radicalized into being radical socialists / communists, such as Bernie Sanders and Octavio Cortez and many others. They lie to you about it. They say they're socialists or socialist light when they're socialists on steroids, which basically means communism. So when they asked Lenin what the difference between socialism and communism was, he joked it was socialism that was in a hurry.
So isn't the often recounted date of 1984 actually a 100-year memorial of the founding of the Fabian Society?
Correct. And your friend Orwell was at one time a paid intelligence agent, and he was a member of the Fabians. But when he saw the Spanish Civil War, which was a fight in reality between communists and fascists, fascists are sisters or cousins to communists. Fascism is not right-wing. It is left-wing. Nazi means National Socialists. That was the street slang. So after World War I, all of these countries went fascist because they had to buy the people off. Fascism is socialism. They had to buy the people off with benefits because the whole of Europe was bankrupted. As we said, the Great Depression began in 1918 in Europe, not with the stock market crash in America. It began after World War I in Europe. Remember, four emperors were knocked off the throne: the Tsar, the Sultan of Turkey, the two Kaisers, one in Austria and one in Germany. So all of the countries, even the winners, were bankrupt from World War I. England had to buy its people off with socialism as well. So you're already in socialism everywhere. The question is, how far are we going to go at this point? So you'll own nothing and be happy, and a technocratic society where 90-95% of the world is on universal basic income, the minimal amount that you get to live, your little cubicle, and you'll own nothing. That's world communism.
So is it safe to say that even though the countries lost, even those that won with bankruptcy, the international bankers most assuredly did not?
Well, the people at the top always win. So they want there were memos we have now where the people at the top wanted to keep the war going longer because they were making so much money. But there were other factors that necessitated the end of the war by that time. But England went in being the biggest creditor nation in the world, and it came out of the war being the biggest debtor nation, which gave rise to the United States eventually as the biggest creditor nation, and would lead towards the dollar becoming the world currency after World War II and the Bretton Woods Agreement. So there are many, many things that we are going to start with the Crimean War in the 1850s, which was an embarrassing defeat for Russia. Nicholas I launched that war. He had also put down a revolt by the Decembrists earlier, and they called Nicholas the crowned policeman of Europe. He ruled with an iron fist. He died as the war was coming to a close. His son, Alexander II, who is known as the Tsar Liberator, took over. He's called the Tsar Liberator because he freed the serfs. Now, the ban on masonry in Russia continues till 1905, and we will get to that a little later. But Alexander II, who freed the serfs, by the way, they had to pay for their own freedom. They were freed. They had to buy the land, and the Russian banks were formed and to start giving them loans to or mortgages to buy their land and farm it on their own. I'll leave this conclusion to the listeners of The Crow Show because they're very intellectual. What they got by freeing the serfs, they knew, the Tsar at that time, Alexander II, knew that in order to compete with the West, they were going to have to start industrializing. So freeing the serfs meant that they were going to move from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And what selling of the land and not only allowing the serfs to buy the land and farm it, they were going to start going on to the tax rolls as workers. And these 25 million serfs that were freed were going to start paying tax on their income, and they were going to start paying land tax. It also meant that having to buy the land and pay it off with loans was going to be great for the banks with interest. So I don't have to spell out where we're going with this. It meant more for the coffers of the banks and the Russian government and was more profitable than feudalism was, land reform. Next question.
I'll just make a quick point here, Fortune. The reason I asked you how looming this threat is while you cover the rise of communism on two different fronts, but the one that really matters is the one that happened in Russia, is because the date 1984, when I asked you that question, I was almost certain you were going to bring up the Fabians, which you did. Everything in this country we've ever heard of 1984, and everybody knows that date, is a 100-year commemoration of the beginning of the Fabians. If you look at the books we had to read in school, one of those is about what we're talking about, and it's titled 1984. Do you get what's being commemorated here? Look at the music and the music albums that carry some version of the 1984 date. And what's more, when I was young, so much of entertainment was designed to draw us in. There are more teen classic movies from in and around the date 1984 than any other time that I'm aware of. And these are classics that hold up today that were targeting the young people of America. And these things don't go away, but they're all related by a common thread, which Fortune defined with the Fabians and the 100-year anniversary of 1984, which is relating directly to communism.
Well, let's go and say something since you brought up a very good point, my friend. In the communist world, which was a very dark gray world, the ruble was an inconvertible currency, not because the Soviet ruble was inconvertible. You couldn't exchange it for anything, not because the communists had planned it that way, because it was worth nothing. So you couldn't really convert the Russian ruble. And it wasn't done that way by design, but communism strips everything from everyone. It took the most rapidly industrializing and fastest growing economy in Europe at the time, and they marched the country back 300 years is not even right, 500 to 600 years into the past, into the real era of the dark ages and the Middle Ages. The communists marched that country. The damage that has been done to the satellite countries that were under the Iron Curtain and Russia itself, Russia today is fastly making progress. The other communist countries, if they if they get online to where they are supposed to be in 100 years, it will be a miracle. That's how damaging what they called the communist experiment was. And when you live in the communist world, everyone was targeted and everything was weaponized. But we're already there in our own world at this time. And the Fabians, remember, the Fabians were the ones, Hitler got his idea about sterilization and racial purity from the Fabians. That was H.G. Wells. People like Arthur Conan Doyle and many other famous people, Aldous Huxley and his brother Sir Julian Huxley, the Fabians just went underground because the Nazis exposed their plan. They went underground and were very silent. But if you look them up, David Attenborough, Sadiq Khan, Boris Johnson, these were all Fabians.
And they didn't just go underground, they encoded in what I mentioned, but I've got to ask you point blank, Fortune, is a subscription-based society where everything is by subscription, does that equal a form of communism?
Well, subscription is willingly. So what are we talking about with subscription? Subscription means you subscribe and that's done, that's as a volunteer, it's by will.
Well, let me know. It's a little more detailed than that. Jason and I were just talking about it. Here's the idea. Yes, subscription is voluntary, but what we're seeing is the idea that a farmer bought a very important piece of equipment. Then he learns that he can't get it fixed unless he brings it back to the manufacturer. Then he learns that what's really going on is he's subscribed to the key and he doesn't own the farm equipment at all. And as you can see, the reason I'm asking this question is because damn near everything is becoming subscription. Even motor vehicles are being considered in that way. So when you get to a motor vehicle, yes, it's choice, but you don't move without it. That's a little bit like saying the power at your house is a choice. So if everything was subscription-based, you would own nothing. That's the point I'm making, I guess. Can you do better than that, Jason?
Well, I was just going to say, it's a very much like a neo-feudalism concept. Yes, you can use the thing, you can't own it, and you're going to pay a fee to be able to use it, just like the serfs did working the land way back when.
Can we draw the line to some kind of weird technical communism is the point I'm trying to make.
If you have no other choice, then if you don't have any other choice, it's like only one newspaper. So if there's no other choice and you have to use it, they say it's subscription, but you have to go along to get along, which is basically where we are now. We're all being herded in a very different way than the communists did it. The communists had done it with an iron fist from the very, very beginning with ruthless murder and other methods. But let's go back to see what brought us there. So when Alexander III believed in reform, and he was a reformer, but at the time, see, the Tsar was looked at as the little father, the Tsar and the Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox Church. It had the confidence and the respect of most of the people. But Alexander III at that time was plagued by many assassination attempts by the anarchists. Now, in order to understand anarchy, anarchy is a true right-wing philosophy because it means no government. That is the ultimate side of the pendulum for right wing. Anarchy is right wing. It's not left wing. No government is right wing. But everyone has to be a grown up and responsible and work in a peaceful way. The anarchists were really the forerunners of the communists and the social radicals. And a true anarchist doesn't use violence. So that they weren't who they said they were. There were anarchist assassinations. The king of Greece was assassinated in 1913 while walking outside of his palace. The emperor Franz Joseph of Austria's wife was assassinated by an anarchist while boarding a boat. The anarchist assassination of Franz Ferdinand, which started World War I in Serbia, that was the nephew and the heir to the throne of the Austrian Empire. It was Franz Joseph's nephew. So there were anarchist assassinations going on all over. So as a matter of fact, Tsar Alexander III was late going into supper one night, about a half hour late, and the dining room blew up. The anarchists had planted bombs in his dining room, and everybody was saved because he was late that night and dressing and coming down for supper. So the anarchists were everywhere, and it was an inside job because it was a royal palace, which was very, very well patrolled, and they managed to get in anyway. So this is what Alexander III had to face. And Alexander III ultimately meets his fate because his carriage was armored and a bomb was rolled under it. But this was a very kind man, and he got out of the carriage to see if his soldiers in the procession were okay. And when he stepped out, another bomb was thrown at him, and his legs were blown off. He did live. His son, the future Tsar, Alexander III, who was a hulk of a man, something like 6'5", 6'6". And I mean a hulk. This man could bend horseshoes with his bare hand. He carried his father in pieces into the palace, and Alexander III died a few days later. Which brings us to the next Tsar, Alexander III, and that date is, I think, 1881.
You got anything, Jason, or shall he continue?
Well, who was instigating the anarchists?
Well, they were different groups in different places. Was anybody instigating them? That, you know what? That would be a very, very interesting research project to find out, because they were being funded. So who was funding these people? Like we said, Marx and Engels. The joke with Marx is everybody around Marx met a very bad end. Engels was the banker who financed Karl Marx. And as we know, Karl Marx was the father of communism. And these were very, very dark, sinister people. And one thing, Mrs. Marx was very, very frustrated with her husband, Karl. So she said to him, Karl, instead of sitting around writing and talking about capital, why don't you go out and make some?
I made a similar comment in our episode.
You know, you've listed off all these anarchist assassinations and attacks. By the time you get to Franz Ferdinand, I think what needs to be recognized here, they changed the trajectory of the world. World War One, in my view, and correct me if you don't agree, please, at World War One, you have a world the way it was, and then after that event that launches World War One, you have a completely different trajectory for the world leading to World War Two.
Everything since World War One, as we have discussed before, has been a chipping away at basically everything. Remember, pre-World War One, dear friends, when you watch Mary Poppins, all these homes you saw in London were rented, okay? There wasn't this push for home ownership. That came under Margaret Thatcher. And home ownership in the United States, the push came for the average person after World War II. So when you look at Mary Poppins with Mr. and Mrs. Banks, one father supported a family, and he was middle class. They lived in a home of a few stories, and you had nanny, cook, and maid in a middle-class family. So it was a richer society. Your money went a lot further, and you could get much more. It was a much richer age than the age we're living in. So post-World War One, you start paying more for less. The cities, apartment living, the house, you know.
You become house poor.
It's been a chipping away. The 20th century has been the bloodiest century in human history, and it's been a chipping away. And World War One just showed the powers at the top how easy it was to get the males to enlist and go to war and go to their death under the banner of nationalism and patriotism.
So I think the chipping away that you're illustrating brings us back to Jason's question and the anarchists there. I mean, maybe we should do an episode after this about who was behind that, because that's where it begins. And if it's an intentional chipping away, I think Jason's question is quite pertinent.
Well, you know, my two friends, everyone that listens to this show says it's probably the most esoteric show they've ever listened to before. And we will do a lesson and a session, a crow show on the anarchists. But let me remind everybody, no matter who you are, there's always sabotage in the ranks, whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president, whether you're the king on the throne like Henry VIII, who was an absolute ruler. The only thing that kept Henry VIII and Stalin on, you know, people that are that erratic and cruel usually wind up with a pillow over their head while they sleep or a knife in their back, like was done to Caligula. So the thing that allowed them to survive so long was that they kept everyone off balance. Everyone was so afraid of them. So there's always sabotage in the ranks, no matter who you are. In your own families, there's sabotage in the ranks, even if it's just four or five people. So someone's always working against you somewhere. And as we go forward, Alexander III, this is one of the most interesting stories I've ever heard in my life. When he becomes Tsar, he sits down at the desk of his father, because now he is going to become the new Tsar. His father has just died. And he sits down at his father's desk. And what does he find on the desk? He finds a manifesto and a warning. Now, this is supposed to be the safest room in the world from the anarchists, that any thought or attempt to punish the people who assassinated for good cause his father as an enemy of the people will be met with assassination and violence against him and his family.
So his first day, he sits down to a threat on a room that's supposed to be impenetrable.
Correct. One of the safest rooms, perhaps the safest room in the world at that time. So somebody in the palace somewhere was in on it and let them in. And he had smoke coming out of his ears. The people around him, when he called for the footmen, said they actually saw smoke coming out of his ears. His first command was, I want everybody in the palace, anyone and everyone that had access to this room lined up. If they're not here, you find them, you get them. And he said, I want them all lined up before me. And he walked and he said to everyone, whoever did this is going to be sought out. They are going to pay, and whoever helped them is going to pay. And if my people, if the detectives can't find out who did this, he picked a footman off his shoulders and said, I'll find him myself and shake the life out of him. And he threw the footman to the ground. He said, and I will find you and do it on my own. And at that moment was born the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret police. The people who did that, the anarchists who were responsible, were found. There were over 300 that were rounded up. Some of them spent a few years waiting their death in the prison, the Peter and Paul fortress. Some of them committed suicide in their cells. Others died of sickness or not eating. The people who were most involved were hanged. One of them was a young man whose brother was named Vladimir Lenin. Their family name was Ulyanov. Lenin was a name that was taken like Stalin later on. These were fictitious names they gave themselves. Stalin meant of steel. So Vladimir Lenin was not his real name. But Vladimir Lenin's brother was one of those so-called anarchists that was responsible for the assassination of Alexander II.
Well, wait a minute, though. That's a turn of events. If anarchy is far right and communism is far left, what you just told us was his brother was acting in the far right, and he's going to establish the far left through communism. Do I have it right?
They use the term anarchists. Anarchists are far right. They do not believe in government. Anarchists do not believe in taxes. Anarchists do not believe in socialism. Anarchists do not use violence. So, like I said, these were the early communists parading under the name of anarchists.
So a false label put up.
And remember, in truth, the real anarchy and the communists and the real anarchists are sworn enemies.
And what was their supposed grievances against the Tsar and his family?
Well, in their manifestos, they always say they're for the people. But as we saw with the French Revolution, they weren't for the people. As was communism. Communists, they promised bread and freedom and delivered neither. They just delivered mass violence. Their grievance was, if you really look at what they were asking for, it was a socialist, it was a radical socialist/communist agenda. So that's why I say they were they were parading and masquerading. They were in the guise of anarchists, but they were really communists. And I'm sure at many of these meetings, there were people that were real anarchists. But during these meetings, they kept having breaks. People kept breaking into smaller and different groups because they didn't agree with one another. But as we will soon see, the same thing happened during the French Revolution with the Reign of Terror, as happened during the Bolshevik Revolution. He who became the most violent and was willing to use the most extreme measures were the people who rose and gained the power. So we go to Alexander III, who forms the Russian secret police, and all of those people were rounded up. Alexander III decided to move in. He reigned from 1881 to 1894. His wife was Princess Dagmar of Denmark. Her sister was the Queen of England. That was Victoria's daughter-in-law, who married Edward VII, Princess Alexandra. The other Danish brother became the King of Greece, and the other brother became the King of Denmark. So Dagmar, we now have a Danish princess becoming the Tsaritsa of Russia, the Tsar's wife, and she fathers Nicholas II, who will be the last Tsar. Was very quiet, gentleman, very well educated. And Alexander III starts instituting many, many reforms, primarily financial. He knows that Russia has to industrialize. And under him, the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway has begun. He turns his palace at Gatchina. He chooses not to live more in the Winter Palace. He lives in a smaller palace outside of St. Petersburg. Remember, at that time, the capital was St. Petersburg, not Moscow. And that's where the high aristocrats lived, on the Nevsky and Moika embankment. And he was very comfortable. He was the first Tsar to be faithful to his wife, meaning no mistress. His father, Alexander II, had a mistress who he eventually married. And Alexander III, had he been able to repeal the reforms of his father, he would have, but he knew it had been too late. He was a reactionary. He was not comfortable for the world that was moving forth. But Alexander III is a very, very interesting character because under him, there were no wars. From the Crimean War, which he was alive for, he remembered what an embarrassing defeat it was for Russia. So he had passed an imperial edict, and it's called an ukaz. The imperial edict was that Russia would never get involved in a war unless it were first attacked. It would have a strong military for defense, but it would not involve itself in any wars unless it were directly and firstly attacked. There was a railway accident with the imperial train, which people at first thought was a terrorist act, and it wasn't. The train was going too fast, and the imperial train had derailed. And at that time, the Tsar held the carriage up with his bare hands in time for his family to get out. And that is what led to his failing health later on in life and eventually his death. Alexander III is a hero in many ways because he wanted financial reform for Russia. He wanted balanced books.
No war.
No war, which was very, very unusual. And even though people called him a tyrant and a brute, it was the greatest age of theater and literature and cultural creativity. It was the age of Pushkin and Chekhov. And when he went to visit the relatives overseas, and by the way, for those of you that are listening who want more information on me, my mother and her grandmother were from the Danes. So the Dowager Empress, the Tsar's mother, the last Tsar's mother, and the Queen, Queen Alexandra of England and the King of Greece, that's my mother's side, the Danish royal family. But we go further on this one. When he traveled abroad and he was meeting all of the relatives, he was the favorite of the children. He would bend horseshoes for them, which the children kept for the rest of their lives. But Alexander III also took to carrying his own pistol. And when people had gone to Gatchina, the palace that he was most comfortable in outside of St. Petersburg, they said it looked like an armed camp. There were soldiers every 5 feet because he was going to protect his wife and his family. And to be fair, the anarchists under his reign and the violence of the anarchists was practically, it became a cottage industry. It became almost non-existent under his reign. He was very, very much for orthodoxy. He was a family man, which carried over into his son, who remained faithful to his wife his whole life, which was unusual for the czars or royalty in general, because they always had mistresses. And when that train accident happened, Alexander III remembered meeting a railway man who was very, very powerful and impressive, who said that the trains were going too fast on the tracks, which were not equipped for that speed. And the man's name was Sergei Witte. And Sergei Witte came from a noble family of Russians and Baltic Russians, but he had no title himself. And at that time, Witte and the Tsar struck up a friendship, and Witte eventually became finance minister under Alexander III, to the point where and he trusted Witte implicitly. So Witte had not yet become Count Witte, which comes with the negotiations of the Russo-Japanese War when the Russians lost to the Japanese. But at this time, Witte had become finance minister, and he was also controlling the railroads. So on his deathbed, when Alexander III was dying, he told his son, the future Tsar Nicholas, to listen to Witte, for he is the noblest and the wisest of all of the ministers. Whatever Witte says, you are to do. And that brings us to the next Tsar, Nicholas II, the next and the last Tsar.
Ending the Romanov line after 300 years, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct. They celebrate 300 years, I think, in 1913. So that would have been 1613. They had been on the throne. And the first Tsar, I think, was Michael Romanov. I think his name was Michael. He replaces the Rurik dynasty, which was founded by Rurik the Viking. So there you are. Let us go further, my friends. Proceed with the questions.
Was he not looked upon favorably by the people?
Tsar Alexander III, the Tsar was called the Little Father. So he was very, very well loved and trusted by the people. And the Orthodox Church and the Tsar were considered very, very close, if not one and the same. So Orthodoxy and the Tsar were basically one and the same. And as a matter of fact, that the government did collect taxes for the church. So when the government tax collected, it was also tax collecting for the Russian Orthodox Church.
So just to bring us up to speed, the current and last Tsar was directed to listen to Count Whittier at all costs, and he fails to do so, and that's going to cost him dearly.
Well, we come to Nicholas II, who comes to the throne. There was a problem. There was a big, big riot for Nicholas II's coronation, and some 300 people lost their lives in a food stampede at the field where there was a great banquet for the people, the poor people in the field going on for the Tsar's ascension to the throne. And there was a stampede that happened, and a few hundred people were killed in the stampede. What happened was the Tsar did not cancel a ball that was going on that night in the palace for the French ambassador and went ahead with it anyway. And people say that was a public relations fiasco, that it should have been canceled. And many people took that as an omen, a bad omen about the Tsar's reign. So the Tsar comes in under that great cloud. Now we go towards the Russo-Japanese War. Count Witte starts playing a very big role. And there is Count Stolypin. Witte is industrial reform, industrial and financial reform. Count Stolypin is agrarian reform. Stolypin believed you had the carrot in the front And the whip from behind, the gentle whip from behind while enticing people with the carrot in front. Now, to be fair to the regime, the Tsar inherited a machine, as any political system is. It was a machine, and it was a colossus, and it was a bureaucracy. This Tsar, the last one, did not know how to rule, and he admitted that. And he wasn't meant for the job, and he didn't want the job. But that primogenitor, the oldest boy of the oldest boy. So with Witte and Stolypin, he stood a chance. We come to the 1905 Russo-Japanese War, where Russia suffers an embarrassing defeat. The first time an Eastern power defeats a Western power. They had to sue for peace. The European countries came in to help Russia in its peace deal with the Japanese. And Count Witte was there doing the negotiations with the Japanese, which is where he receives the Count's title from. So he becomes elevated to Count Witte. As a result of the 1905 war and the embarrassing defeat, there were workers' strikes, which were suppressed by the army. There were workers' strikes, as I said, and there was great unrest in the streets. The Tsar got away with it by the skin of his teeth. The second political disaster came when Father Gapon marched on the Winter Palace. This was an Orthodox priest, followed by hundreds, if not a few thousand people, wanting to give a manifesto, but this was a peaceful march. The Tsar was not in residence that weekend, and the palace guard got nervous. They fired warning shots above the crowd's head and told them to move back and disperse. But when they came onto the palace grounds, the palace guard got nervous, and they shot at the crowd, and people were killed. This was a big, big public relations fiasco. The imperial family returned to the Winter Palace. It was called Bloody Sunday. They called him Bloody Nicholas, and Count Witte was called in. Count Witte had advised the Tsar that he was being very, very obtuse and that the people were coming, and all they were asking for was a constitution and the vote, representation and a constitution. And Count Witte said, the two things which you refuse to give them. Count Witte was very, very adamant about it and kept on pounding his hand in his fist so that the Tsar would listen, because the Tsar was known to show no emotion and just stand there and keep smoking. Well, one of the unfortunate things was the Tsar's father said, listen to Witte, and the Tsar listened to nothing of what Witte said. But the Tsar did form a Duma, which is a parliament, and he started giving the people representation, or what they thought was representation, but they still did not have the vote. So he granted a parliament to the various political parties, but it also had to be stacked with various counterweights from the imperial family and veto powers. So that was 1905. And we go up towards a little later. Count Stolypin is assassinated by anarchists in Kiev at the Royal Opera House in 1911. And by that time, the Tsar had had it with Witte, whom he felt was a troublemaker, and was pushing Witte aside into positions where Witte may have had some sort of title, but no power. And he was told by other people in his cabinet not to listen to Witte, because Witte was a troublemaker. So as we are marching from 1911 forward to what we call the brink or the abyss, which is World War I, Witte starts to find two bombs in his house. Two times he came into his home and found time bombs. So he knew it was time to get out of politics and retire. And he strongly suspected, he knew without knowing, that those time bombs were put in his house by the Russian secret police, the Okhrana, which from the time it had started, like the CIA, when the Tsar had founded it in 1881, where now, I'd say 30 years later. So the Okhrana had grown to take on a life of its own, like the CIA. And Witte called, who knows what is going on in the labyrinths of the Okhrana. And that leads us up to the brink of World War I.
And I apologize, my comment about Count Witte came a little bit early, didn't it? Jason, do you have anything that you'd like to bring up before we break hour one and prep for hour two?
Did any of the royal family have any idea what was coming with the communist revolution?
No. Like we said, Witte is a great hero. Witte is up there with the Roman Emperor Majorian 457 to 461. That's 15 years before the empire falls. At the time that we're speaking of now, the ban on masonry was relaxed by the Tsar. Masonry was made legal and allowed with the 1905 uprisings and the Russo-Japanese War. And a man named Kerensky starts to play an important political role in the Duma, pressing for a republic or a constitutional monarchy. He becomes a very, very open and vociferous voice. There were two Dumas. The first one was dissolved, and then there was a second Duma that was created. So at this point, there are great things going on in the city where there is unrest with the factory workers, and there is violence. The Black Hundreds were the people that Stolypin was fighting, and many of them were hanged by the government in forms of taking revenge for the still what they were calling anarchist uprisings, which under Tsar Nicholas started becoming more and more common, whereas under his father, they were very, very rare. So we're moving towards the brink, and other forces are starting to come up and boil in terms of the unions, which were communist and socialist infiltrated. There was great labor unrest as the peasants were marching into the cities looking for work. So the cities were growing. And we're marching into a different age now. And Nicholas did not understand that. Nicholas did not want to give up any of his power because the Tsar was called the autocrat of all of the Russias, meaning that he and he alone was responsible for government. And there we are, my friends.
So is there a sense of where the funding, so clearly communism has been boiling around. You even pointed out the relationship of a brother of one of the key figures that comes to be known for communism. Is there international funding going on? Are there bankers? Is there a sense of what's funding the extreme left that's about to emerge?
Well, there's always something funding. So I would say the Masons may have had a hand in this because Kerensky was a Mason. And when Kerensky died in exile after the Bolsheviks pushed his government out, so Kerensky was looking for a republic, and the Bolsheviks took over after a few short months, and Kerensky went into exile, and when he died, the Russian Orthodox Church refused to bury him on consecrated ground or give him a mass in the name of the church. Because he had gone against the Tsar and because he was a Mason. So, and also we must bring in that once the communists came to power, they wanted the Orthodox Church out and gone because communists are not only, they're anti-religion. So they're anti-Christian, they're anti-Judaism, they're anti everything. They did not want religion at all. And under the communist regimes, any religion that was allowed in the Soviet Russia was co-opted by the Communist Party, just as Catholicism or Christianity was co-opted in its early days by Rome, which is why it was called the Russian, which is why it was called the Roman Catholic Church. So the communists co-opted the Orthodox Church, and anybody that was a legitimate priest in Russia either was murdered, was sent away to the gulags, or emigrated to form the Russian Church in exile, which to this day has not reunited with the Russian Church in Russia. And that leads us up, my friends, to hour two of the Crow Show.
All right, we're going to take a short break. And I mean, it's almost unbelievable what's bumping around in your head, Fortune. We've had so many discussions that go so far beyond what we've managed to cover in hour one. To remind everybody, Fortune's going to be having an event on December 12 in London in the Mayfair area. It's going to be Spiritual Alchemy. It's going to be held from 12 p.m. to 2, possibly going towards 3, and it will be held in what he's calling the Alchemical Laboratory. We will be posting links. There will be a thread in the forum as there was last time. Jason, anything you want to add before I line us up for a quick break?
That is because Stalin called these people useful idiots. When the communists from other countries came to Russia, from other countries to help build the Russian utopia, Stalin called all the communists outside of Russia useful idiots, because Stalin wasn't a communist. He was just an autocrat and a ruthless dictator. Stalin wasn't an ideologue. He was a madman. Well, an evil madman. And he was even Lenin did not want Stalin in power. So in the early days of communism, Lenin's motto was anybody but Stalin. And Lenin knew the danger of Stalin as well. And Lenin died early. So he might have even been poisoned by Stalin early on, which is my surmise and theory on it. But you're talking about ruthless brutes who come to power. And the people that you're talking about that want to do the experiment again, they think that they're going to be taken care of by the state. Once they took hold of the country, the communists gave you the absolute least you needed to live and worked you to the, they took the maximum and extracted the maximum from you in work and life, and they gave you the least in return. And if you complained about it, if you were lucky, you just got beaten to a pulp and sent home. If you weren't lucky, they sent you to the gulags where they worked you to death.
All right, there it is. I guess that's where we get the saying, or even the reason for this episode, if you can't comprehend history, you're doomed to repeat it. I wonder, as the promise of the new era comes, two things that are in the offing, or so it seems, is that human consciousness and spirituality will rise. One wonders if the power of spirituality will ever be able to fend off such uprisings. Hour One is free to everybody at Crow 777 Radio. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to everything. The forums, the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, all my solar work. There's a litany of information and forums and comment sections that are open to you once you have membership. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back for Hour Two. I hope to see you logged in as a member for Hour Two. And truly, the information that's been laid down here, much of it, you're just not going to find it anywhere else. Go look at what Wikipedia has to say about what we just covered. With that, we're going to take a short break and be back for Hour Two. I'd like to wish everybody everywhere a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.